So, anyone have anything on their mind?
I have a question.
Yes.
When we were talking in the car, the difference between Vipassana and non-dual, is that what it?
Advaita.
Advaita, oh. Yeah.
Difference between Vipassana?
And Advaita.
Okay, and well, they're kind of two different things, but I mean they are related. I mean, or do you mean the difference between what's called the practice of Vipassana and what's called the practice of Advaita Vedanta? Is that what you mean? I mean, the word Vipassana means insight. And the word Advaita means mandual. And one of the major insights that we can have is to realize the non-duality of things. So in that regard, there's not a difference there, but there's a relationship. But usually the term Advaita, that's actually a Sanskrit term. It's usually used in connection with a particular spiritual path called Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta. And it is very, very similar to what the Buddha taught, very similar to Buddhism. There are some interesting differences that in some ways aren't really differences. In the Advaita, there is this search for the real self. And in Buddha, there's sort of the realization that there is no self. But if you look at how, if you understand what it means in Buddhism to say there is no self, and then if you go and look at what it is that the Vedantists are saying when about the self that they're in search of, they end up being the same thing in the end. There really is no difference at all. The self that is being denied is a self that is separate and is ultimately real. But the really important thing is the self that's separate, that separates us. And in the Vedanta, you're looking for the true self, and the true self isn't this self that feels separate. The true self is everything. So you see that they're really saying the same thing. That if you realize that we are not separate from anything, from everything, we're not separate from that ultimate reality is totally interconnected and interpenetrating, and there is no part of this reality that is separate in any other way than as a projection of the mind upon it. That's the realization that Buddha is leading us towards. And Advaita is realizing basically the same thing, that the Atman, the real Atman, is the universal. And in both of these points of view, they prompt us to understand that if we think of a whole consisting of parts, that we're still going to be in the wrong, have the wrong idea. And the ancient simile or metaphor that was used to try to convey the relationship of what appear to be the parts, separate cells, and so forth, to the whole, was Indra's net. It was a net that was infinite in all directions. And every place that two strands crossed, there's a jewel. Each jewel has an infinite number of faces, and each face, each facet of the jewel reflects the entire net. So the entire net is in every jewel, and every jewel is in every, it is completely distributed throughout the entire net. And then we have a much more modern technological analogy for the same thing, which is the holographic negative. Because if you make a holographic negative, which is a negative that you shine light through it and you get a three-dimensional image, the curious thing about that negative is you can chop it up into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces, and every single piece, no matter how small, when you shine the laser light through it, it will produce the entire image. And so it's the same idea of the whole in every part, and the part distributed throughout the whole. And so really, bottom line is that insight, the vipassana, or insight into no self, is identical to the realization of non-duality. How does that fit with what your discussion was and your thoughts and so forth? But there's people who love to take these two and point out how different they are and argue about all the differences. And it's really easy to do that because all the Buddhist Dharma is a conceptual model of something. It is a model. It's purely conceptual. There's an arbitrariness to any conceptual model. And not only that, any conceptual model is, in many ways, not the same as what it's trying to model. And the same is true that the Vedanta is. It's just a different conceptual model. And because in the arbitrariness of the selection of the concepts out of which you construct the model, you know, it's put together in two different ways. And neither one of these models perfectly reflects ultimate reality. And therefore, you can take either one of these models and you can hone in on the ways in which on its imperfections. And then if you want to make two systems of thought look really different, you can hone in on the different imperfections in either one. And of course, this allows you, if you're so inclined, to say, see, the Buddha Dharma doesn't have this imperfection, but the Vedanta does. Or if you're on the other side, you can say, oh, the Vedanta doesn't have this imperfection, but look, the Buddha Dharma does. And so there are books, really thick books, many of them, that are written comparing and contrasting and showing how, even though the Vedanta and Buddhism look similar, they're really not. They're very different. My approach is quite the opposite. Even though you can look at these in ways that they appear very different, they're not.
You know, I've been spending my granddaughter's been here for a week. And I've been exposed to a 15-year-old mind for a whole week.
Uh-huh.
And that's all I've got to say is, oh my God. And it's like, she's totally ruled by her senses.
By her senses? What about her emotions? I recall being 15 years old. I was ruled by my emotions. Good morning. It's good to have you join us.
Hi, good morning. Good morning.
Wonderful to see your son again. And is this your daughter?
Yes, this is Annika.
Oh, Annika. Well, it's wonderful to have you here. But could you say more about her being ruled by her senses?
Well, what I see happening is that everything is what's coming in. If I don't like this, if it doesn't taste right, you know, if it doesn't look right, tremendous amount of value judgments on stuff from outside. And the thing that I've noticed is that when she's confronted with reality, then she makes up stories so that her concept will fit reality. And I'm going, you know, this is raw, right? It's just raw information, right? And it's no different than what happens with adults when they get older. It's just becomes, it just gets more subtler as you go on.
Yeah, we learn to do it more smoothly.
Yes.
We're doing exactly the same thing. Yes. The judgment part is interesting because, like these wonderful children we have, right, in here with us. I remember I've had some interesting recollections of my childhood, and I spent the first few years of my life in Bisbee, and I remember it being a revelation that there were actually places where every house was on the street. Because for me, the world, the only world I knew, is where you had to climb past other houses to get to houses, and that's just the way the world was. I took it for granted, you know. And the other thing is that in Bisbee, very few people have backyards. But there's a lot of front yards, and very often the front yards are fenced. And most of them have a gate in the middle of the fence of the front yard. That was the world that I lived in until I was, you know, almost school age. And then we moved to Texas, which is totally flat. Everybody has big yards. They have big backyards, small front yards, big fenced-in backyards. And most places, curiously enough, have, you know, they have these chain-link fences with a gate in the corner. And I remember what a dramatic shift in my perspective of the world it was to discover things could be in different ways. You know, and I think when I became an adolescent, I appreciated how totally different everything could be, and I felt myself confident to start making judgments about how things should be, and what was better, what was, you know, rather than just accepting what is what is, and that's the way the world is. All of a sudden, there were so many different possibilities, and I felt like I was just as competent as anybody else to decide which was better and which was worse, and so I got into it totally. I think when I was 14, 15 years old, I was extremely judgmental about everything. I mean, can you remember being like that? And part of it was just the discovery that there were so many ways that things could be. But also part of it is, you know, coming into your selfhood and saying, okay, I'm important too. What I think matters, and all these people that I used to take for granted that because they were taller than me, they were, you know, they knew more and everything else. It's not true anymore. I'm almost as tall as they are. So therefore, my opinion, everybody has a right to my opinion. That's actually a quote from my son Charles when he was about that age. He says, one day he just very defiantly announced, everybody has a right to my opinion. But we are ruled by our senses. Yeah.
I've been thinking about insight and mundane and super mundane insights, and it seems that it's really easy for the mind to grasp and comprehend mundane insights. Well, it totally makes sense that we're all connected. It totally makes sense that there's no self, individual self. And it's the realization of the super mundane insights, which I think seems to me happen at a deeper level than just the conscious mind. And trying to figure out a way to make that process happen faster. Because it seems like it's so like, I'm totally not in control of that process of supramundane, of insights changing from mundane insights to supramundane insights, where they really get down and they can really affect dukkha.
Yeah.
Would you comment, please?
Yes, certainly. So, my experience of my own mind is that there are many, many different minds in this head, and that my conscious experience of what's going on in my mind is just a really tiny part of what's actually going on. So the picture that I have is of hundreds or thousands of different minds, each functioning in isolation. And what my conscious experience is, you know, that when one of those minds projects something into consciousness, then all of the other minds, it becomes available to all of the other minds as information. It's the only way they have of communicating with each other, really. Mm-hmm. Or if not, and maybe not in absolute terms, the only way, because there is another way. But certainly, functionally, the way we are, you know, you're a collection of all these different mental components, each with its own job, and each quite limited. But you function as a whole, because in every moment, in every minuscule moment, there are different minds projecting information and consciousness, and all those other minds that happen to be interested receive that information when that happens, and they can in turn project something into consciousness, and so your conscious experience is of the flow of information from these invisible parts of yourself that are coming into consciousness. Now, each of those parts of yourself, each of those sub-minds that make you up, has learned through experience and out of that experience constructed its own model of the way reality is. Right? Maybe just to digress, think about, forget sub-minds for a moment, just think about a mind, comes into existence, born, and it doesn't know anything, but then sensory experience begins to happen, and that mind tries to make sense out of this sensory experience. And so it constructs a reality to explain that experience. And as it accumulates more and more experience, it keeps refining that model of reality that it has that serves to explain and predict, to explain what is being experienced and to be able to predict the future, that if a particular action is taken, what can change that future. So you're not only predicting the future, but you're also predicting how you can change the future. So that's how I see all of these sub-minds that make us up. Each one of them has assimilated information over the course of our lives. Each one of them has its particular job to do. I mean, think of it, there's one part of your mind that basically its job is to decide when you're going to get angry. Okay? And maybe another part of your mind, its job is to decide when you're going to be afraid. Or when you're happy or something other like that, you know. They have these kinds of jobs. There's some other job, some other mind, its job is to build a model of who you are, what kind of person you are, and guide the rest of you in behaving consistently in that kind of pattern, what your values are and what your beliefs and things like that. There are parts of your mind, their job is very simple. It's just you take in visual information and it interprets visual information. And if you get really good at recognizing antique widgets, So there's some part of your mind that that's its specialty. You know, it's accumulated everything, all the information it can about antique widgets, and its world is one where different antique widgets have different values, right? So your mind is this huge collection of sub-minds, all with their different jobs. And each one, functioning independently, has created its kind of view of reality, of the way things are. So when we talk about insight, we're talking about changes in the intuitive, I use the word intuitive because what happens in consciousness, you know, what's as opposed to what's happening in the unconscious. What happens in consciousness is the result of what's already happened unconsciously. And so our intuition about the way things are, our intuitions about people, our intuitions about, you know, basically everything's an intuition. So there's an invisible part of ourselves that has constructed models, and this arrives in consciousness as our intuitive understanding of reality, of who we are, of who the different people around us are, of the significance of different situations, of the kind of world we live in. You get the idea? Mm-hmm. So our worldview is really this massive composite. And it's coming from an intuitive level of knowing and understanding. It's these invisible, simpler sub-minds that make us up. So, throughout our life, we've had insight experiences. We had, you know, your granddaughter's age, she's having a lot of insight experiences in the sense that she had a worldview that worked fine when she was 9 or 10. Now she's 15. It doesn't work. And so she is going through the process of discarding a lot of the pieces of that worldview and modifying the worldviews, seeing things differently. She's not even aware it's happening because most of it's happening at an unconscious level. But her conscious experience is that the way she sees the world, the way she sees other people, and the way she reacts to it is changing dramatically. That's what happens to us in that phase of life in particular, but it actually has been happening throughout her life. She's had experiences that, in one way or another, didn't make sense in terms of how she thought the world worked. And so what she's done in order to incorporate those experiences is to tweak the way she thinks the world works so that it now accommodates that. And every time that happens, It's been a movement. Most of the time, hopefully, it's a movement in a direction that makes it easier for her to function in the world, easier for her to be successful and happy. Of course, it can go the other way too, as we well know. But that's what's happening: is new experiences are being, you know, they're in conflict with the existing unconscious worldviews that we hold, and then the different parts of our mind that hold those views are being modified to incorporate that. So those are insights. So when we're talking about these major insights, you know, the things that cause us suffering, we have this view, this intuitive view. When we open our eyes in the morning, we open our eyes in a world of separate objects, and we're one separate object amongst many. And when we open our eyes in the morning, our intuitive worldview is that how happy or unhappy we're going to be in the course of the day depends on what happens to us, our interaction with all these other separate objects. And that's actually the intuitive worldview that we're trying to change. Now, listening to me talk, reading a book, having a meditation experience, going for a walk and suddenly having a realization, these are all experiences that in one way or another will force some part of our mind to make a shift in order to accommodate them. And the Dharma, you could think of the Dharma as really a systematic process designed and intended to lead you to have the kind of experiences that are going to change the way that the intuitive worldview that you hold. And so it creates insight experiences, and if those experiences are acted upon appropriately, then you actually have insights. And the reason that you know you've had an insight is because there's been some shift in the way you perceive things. But remember, there's many parts to this mind. So one part might get it, that doesn't mean that another part has. Out of all the different parts of your mind, a third of them might get it, but the other two-thirds don't. Or two-thirds might get it, might get something different, and another third doesn't. And so, now, if you listen to somebody talk and you read a book, and if you think about things, the parts of your mind that are going to achieve insight are the parts of your mind that engage in those kinds of highly conceptual, rational, logical, you know, kinds of processes. And you can actually get to the place where intellectually you understand these truths perfectly, absolutely perfectly. But out of the totality of your mind, that may represent, who knows, I'll just pick a number, but that may represent 10% of your mind. So 10% of your mind understands it. And that 10% only functions in the realm of rational, logical discourse. So that means that you could have a conversation with somebody about this insight and make a sterling presentation, debate somebody, convince other people, whatever else. But when you turn around and walk out the door into a situation and the response to that situation is generated by other parts of your mind, which are non-intellectual, rather they are emotional and so on and so forth, you're behaving as if you didn't know a grain of what you just expounded so brilliantly. So different kinds of experiences change the worldview of different parts of our mind. And so this is one reason that there is this eightfold path. So right understanding really gets the intellectual parts of your mind on board. Right intention, or right view as it's sometimes called, gets a different part of your mind. It's the part of your mind that it's not that far removed from the intellectual, but it performs a different function. Every situation you're in, it evaluates it in terms of a value system that you have. You know, and greedy people, aggressive people, happy, outgoing people, there's different kinds of people. And these, how they behave in these different situations, and you know, they look really different. We get to know in this room, you know, for this part of you, I to the extent that I know you, I can realize that the value system that comes into place as you come into each situation has a particular nature and characteristic, and we're all different. In the part of the path that's called right view, you're working on your value system. And you're working on your value system to try to shift the value system away from selfishness towards generosity, from greed to non-greed, what you're trying to do is restructure your value system. That's a different part of your brain, different part of your mind than the intellectual. But it's closely enough related that that intellectual thought processes can help you to do that. Intellectual understanding, you can bring intellectual understanding into your daily interactions with people, and you can use that to shape and mold yourself in that arena. Then there is the part of the Eightfold Path that is virtue, right speech, right action, right livelihood. once again, there's different parts of your mind that are driving what you say in a particular situation, right? And some parts of the, if you look at any human being, you know, and examine them honestly, you find that they are constantly presenting information in ways that are not necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily describe them as reflecting some kind of external truth. There are always shades of distortion intended to bring about some kind of desired result or to influence what somebody else thinks or does and so on and so forth. And of course, in the most overt cases of that, that's obvious lying, or that's obvious slander, or that's obviously engaging in some kind of harsh or derisive speech that's going to impact the way somebody else feels. So the practice of right speech is all about working with those parts of your mind and bringing them to the same level of insight that you may have already achieved intellectually, but that those parts of your mind, you know, you find yourself still, we'll just use lying as a simplistic example, you find yourself still lying in certain situations, even though intellectually you understand that it's not necessary, it's not desirable, it would be much better, blah, blah, blah. So those other parts of your mind have to get the message, and that's what working on right speech is. It's a practice. And its purpose isn't that you become a person who goes through day after day of your life without ever telling a lie. It's that you become a person who has changed at a deep level in your mind such that you naturally no longer feel the need to distort the truth. Okay? So that's the kind of change you're trying to bring about, which is why just simply following the precepts as rules, keeping the Ten Commandments, whatever, won't change you. Or it won't change you very much. It'll change you in a very superficial way. You know, one observation I have is somebody who tries really hard not to lie lies to themselves so they don't know when they're lying. On the other hand, somebody who has reached a stage of insight that distorting the truth often always creates more problems than they might have believed that distortion was going to resolve. Somebody who has a deep insight into that, naturally, you know, it's like once you realize that touching hot objects burns, you don't do it anymore. Once you've had that insight, you no longer distort the truth because that part of your mind that would have made you do that says, oh, wait a minute, you're going to be worse off if I do that than if I don't, so I'm not going to. Same thing with right. The different aspects, right speech has more than just lying, but same thing with right action, same thing with right livelihood. This is one that, you know, the Buddha presented it as a part of this program of training and called changing ourselves and achieving insight. And I think it's never been understood well by Buddhists, because to me, right livelihood isn't how you make your bucks. It's also everything you do with them. It's absolutely everything to do with how you live in the world. Where you shop, what you buy, what you eat, everything. So anything to do with living in the world is right livelihood. And so if you practice right livelihood, it means you're trying to bring these other insights that you've had, these changes in your value system that you've been working on, you're trying to bring them down to this really fundamental level of seeing myself as a part of a greater whole. Now, what do I kill and eat, and how do I do it, and how do I spend my time, and when I need to go to Tucson, it's going to pollute the atmosphere, it's going to do this, it's going to do that, it's going to do the other thing. So what determines how often I do that and how freely I do that and what kind of vehicle and where I buy my gas and all these other things. And it's all part of the insight process, because anything you do that leads to an understanding by some part of your mind that drives your worldview, that in turn drives your behavior, you know, that's all the insight process. So, right speech, right action, right livelihood, these are powerful practices to bring insight, and to bring the kind of insight that, you know, I mean, real insight changes the way we are, changes who we are and the way we react. Meditation does the same thing. Meditation is training the mind. When it comes to supramundane insight, when it comes to really realizing that there is no self, that everything is interconnected, when it comes to truly realizing how we create our own suffering, when it comes to realizing that we aren't things in a world of things, but rather there's everything is process, and we're all part of the same process. Those are the supramundane insights. They require more powerful kind of experiences for us to see, to get the information into those deeper parts of our mind, to transform the our worldview in a very profound way in that regard. And so that's the purpose of meditation. Right effort, right concentration, right mindfulness. These are all training your mind. Training your mind in such a way that, first of all, through concentration and through cultivation of concentration and mindfulness, you'll have insight experiences that you would not otherwise have had. But even more importantly, because we're always having insight experiences, but we're rarely having insight, it makes you capable of recognizing and appreciating insight experiences when they happen, so that they become a source of this mind-changing, of this soul-changing information. And so we cultivate meditation both to induce more powerful insight experiences and also be able to appreciate all of the insight experiences we always have, already have. Now, just to explain that, insight experiences, you could say an insight experience is any time you have an experience that is in conflict with the way you see, the way you think things are. Right? Anytime you have an experience that conflicts with your inner model of reality, that is an insight experience. Now, you can disregard it, you can rationalize it. There's all kinds of things you can do that keep that insight experience from becoming an actual insight. And this is most of the time what we do. You know, I would say we have a lot of these kinds of insight experiences that bring insight at the mundane level until we reach a certain level of maturity, probably sometime in our 20s. And then our mind starts to become much better at rationalizing away or ignoring conflicts than it is at changing itself in response to things that don't fit anymore. Which I think is the real purpose that a liberal education once served in society, which was to hit people at just that stage in their life when that was beginning to happen, and actually shock them, on the one hand, show them that their thinking can change, on the other hand, shock them into realizing that it has to. But unfortunately, we make people now into technical widgets that fit into a technological system rather than giving them a liberal education that gives them the opportunity to continue to grow and change throughout their lives. But since your internal model of reality can never be perfect, you will always be having insight experiences. They will never cease, because an insight experience is when the ultimate reality out there is sending you the message that, hey, your model isn't right. in this particular way. Ring the bells that still can't ring. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through. And that is, I've always believed, that's what Leonard Cohen was singing about in that song. Yeah. There is a crack in everything. Every one of us, our view of reality is filled with cracks. And the light that comes through is that's when that greater reality outside of ourselves that our mind is trying to model, that's the light that comes through. If we can see the light, we can change in positive and constructive ways. But it seems that in the course of our development, we go from being the kinds of beings that change a lot because we see the light to beings that want not to have to change anymore. Therefore, we find ways to plug up the cracks. Does that address any of the things that you were...
One of the things that has happened is that when her father and I, her brother and her, would play Monopoly, he would let her cheat because she couldn't keep up playing Monopoly if she didn't have her own rules. Right? Guess what?
Yeah.
She thinks she can still do that.
Right. In everything. Yeah. That's really too bad. Hopefully she'll have an insight soon that makes her realize that she can't.
So don't teach your children bad habits.
Those things we think are little, are small things, influence children so much more than we imagine.
They do, yeah. And, you know, I don't think a parent should ever let a child cheat. They should always be called on it.
I don't want to call it cheating. Let's say she had her own set of rules.
She had her own set of rules. Okay.
She might get an extra turn. She might get to throw the dice two or three times more. Same thing, but
that's actually probably even more dangerous, ultimately, than allowing somebody to know the rules and deliberately break them. Because then they end up, not really real appreciating the fact that there are rules. And there's some pretty potent rules in the world. Gravity is one of them. Time is one of them. Yeah. Well, on the other hand, when you play Monopoly with a child, you can cheat in such a way that lets them be more successful. But even that, you don't want to do it past the point when they realize what you're doing. Once they catch you at it, then you got to stop.
Mundane insight as opposed to super mundane? I'm not familiar with
that. Okay. Mundane means worldly. Okay. And so there's all kinds of insights that you can have that they have, they're tremendously beneficial to you. But a lot of other people have those kinds of insights too. Right? So they're worldly insights. Because there are insights into things that are still grounded in a common, worldwide, universally accepted views. Supramundane insights are they're insights that transcend worldly views. What this means specifically is that everyone in the world, except for a few people that have had supramundane insight, believe and feel like they are separate self, and they believe that they are separate selves, and they believe that their ego self is themselves, and they're constantly reacting from that. So a super mundane insight into no self, it goes beyond the worldly. It now, you no longer fit in with everybody else. Realizing the true significance of impermanence, that everything is process, that's a super mundane insight. It goes completely beyond the way the world, the shared view that everybody holds of the way things are. The shared view of the world is that things last. They may not last forever, but they last for a while. They don't see the world as process. Insight into the causes of suffering. The worldly view is that your happiness and your suffering comes from the dynamic interactions between you and the world. That is the worldly view. And we can have a lot of mundane insights into how to make that work better for us, so that we can be happier and suffer less. But those are all mundane insights. You know, all the different ways that we find to game the system. But the super mundane insight is the realization that actually that throws the system out the window. That says our suffering and our happiness come from inside. And so the way to be completely happy and the way to be completely free from suffering is to stop focusing on out there and start focusing on here.
Well, then why is it called mundane? I mean, there's mundane and then there's non-mundane. It sounds like, why are they called super mundane when they're not really mundane at all?
They're not super, it's supra.
Supra.
Supra mundane.
Which means above or beyond mundane.
Super mundane is, if I take a gun, I can get rich, and if I get rich, I'll be happy. That's super mundane.
That's what I thought you were saying. I'm sorry.
Hey, you're not the only one. That's how I've heard it all this time, too.
Oh, no. Okay.
Supra.
Oh, yeah. So there is S-U-P-R-A. And supra means it's outside of. Supra could be inframundane, mm-hmm. but it's supra. It's not only outside of, it goes beyond.
Oh,
it is beyond the mundane. Transcends the mundane. Oh, boy. Sometimes just the simplest things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Make such a difference. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Super mundane insights is what they have in Hollywood.
Yeah. Okay.
And Washington, D.C. And other places like that that don't get it.
So ultimately, does one have to rely simply on being fully present in the moment to catch whatever insights come your way, as opposed to relying on the intellect?
Well, the intellect is very helpful, but yeah, you can't rely on it solely because it will never get you there. And, you know, you can learn a lot and do a lot of important work through reflection, you know, which is reflecting on what's already happened rather than what's happening in the present moment. That has value too. But where the real insight experiences are is in the present moment. And so that's the most important place. It's not the only place, but it is absolutely essential. You can't have insight without presence. No amount of intellectual understanding, and you know, this is a lot of what philosophers do, scientists do, and there are philosophers and scientists who have an intellectual understanding of super mundane truths. I've read books of a number of cognitive scientists who understand the truth of no self in a really profound way. And there are physical scientists that intellectually understand the truth of impermanence, that everything is process. But, you know, when they close their books, they don't know anything. It has made no change in their life. So intellectual understanding by itself is totally inadequate. But it's enormously useful. I mean, I'm quite confident if I could get some of these scientists and philosophers and psychologists to do insight meditation, they would probably gain super mundane insight pretty rapidly, because they already have the intellectual grounding that would help them greatly. People in therapists, psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, people like that, they have not just an intellectual but a more operational understanding of the truth of suffering, of the supramundane insight into suffering. But once again, it's just that it's so compartmentalized in their minds that they haven't brought it in. As a matter of fact, the ones that I've seen are much better at using this understanding with a client, you know, to help a client overcome with suffering. But they can't do it themselves. And they know this. And they say, yeah, well, you know, sometimes I realize I've got a problem and I've got to go talk to a therapist because I can't do it for myself. They could if they practiced, you know, if they practiced meditation, if they did these other kinds of things. Then they could do the therapy on themselves. But,
yeah. Well, I'm a little confused about what meditation, how you reach that. And could you talk about the tension between experiential learning and intellectual learning? There's this, you know, the idea that you will be changed if you walk on coals, say. Mm-hmm. But how are you changed? But you just hit me with something that I really, although I meditate, I don't really get, at least the way you say it. How do you gain this knowledge through meditation? What's supposed to be happening in insight meditation?
Well, there are these two levels. There are things that we're always experiencing that you don't really see and appreciate and understand. And so by gaining stability of attention and by cultivating mindfulness, you begin to see these things and appreciate them, and it allows you to penetrate into them. But the other thing is that in meditation, once you've trained your mind past a certain degree, where you're capable of sitting down and entering into a powerful state of metacognitive awareness, of observing your own mind, and where you can keep, that is an awareness function, and you can keep attention busy off somewhere else while you have this awareness of your own mind, so it doesn't get in the way. But then you can also, when as a result of this introspective awareness, you see things that you hadn't seen before, then you can bring attention to focus on them and understand them in a much clearer and more profound way. So meditation produces insight experiences that you wouldn't otherwise have. Meditation will allow you to actually see that everything is process. You know, that's the awareness part of it. And everything is changing so quickly that normally we can't see that, because what we see is our mind takes this continuous process of change and it clumps it all together in static pictures of reality. Meditation allows you to see past those static pictures of reality and see the constant flux that is your experience, and which, when it becomes insight, leads to realizing that, oh, this is the way things are all the time, everywhere. And then even when you get up from meditation and your mind reverts to its ordinary way of seeing the world, you have this ability to kind of see both ways at once. You can say, okay, it looks this way, but it really is this way, because I've had this experience, and I can tap into that experience now. I can regenerate enough of it now in the moment to see that the way that I have been seeing things is an illusion. In meditation, you can see things arising and passing away, and you can see how your mind creates your reality moment by moment. You can see that happening. Once you see that happening, you don't believe in the reality it creates in the same way. In meditation, one thing about this kind of metacognitive introspective awareness that comes in meditation is that it doesn't have that same self-other duality to it. And so you end up experiencing what's going on in your mind, but not from the perspective of an I, not even from the perspective of an observer. You have, you know, in the experiencing is only the experiencing. And this experience, basically it's the experience of there not being anybody here. This is just happening. Reality is just happening. It's just unfolding, moment by moment, and there's nobody here. There's nobody experiencing it. There's nobody doing it. It's just happening. And that's another profound insight experience, which contributes to insight to no self. But only the trained mind, only the well-trained mind, is likely to have those kinds of experiences. Not only is the well-trained mind likely to have those experiences, it can very consistently have them. It can pretty much generate them at will. You can become aware of, okay, I get up from meditation, I go out in the street, and this is how I experience things, and I know I had this insight, but, you know, it hasn't quite gelled yet. You can go sit back down and you have that same insight experience again. Deepen the insight, get up and go out in the world, and oh, okay, it's gelled more. Okay, but it's still not completely there. Well, I can go sit down and I can have maybe a different insight experience, but it's producing the same kind of insight. This time I get up and go out in the world, and now, oh, okay, now it's all become transparent. You know, I can see it the way it really is. That's the way meditation works. Meditation, it involves two things. You are dominated by movements of attention. The part of your mind that functions in attention creates this powerful self-other duality. It chunks reality up into things that seem so real. One thing you've got to do is, it's a wonderfully powerful faculty that we have, the faculty of attention and all the analysis it produces. But it blinds us. So you have to learn to be able to set it aside, to anchor it to something like the breath, to get it out of the way so you can develop this other capacity that you have. Once you develop this other capacity of awareness, then you can bring attention back into the picture and use it very effectively.
You make it sound so non-frustrating.
Well,
anchoring the attention to the breath.
Well, not just that part, but having also, the insights and going back into the regular world in your mind. I'm getting emotional now because it's frustrating.
It is frustrating, you're right. And probably a really important thing to work on is recognizing when frustration comes and what its roots are, because insight will come from recognizing that. Frustration comes from attachment to particular kinds of results, right? And if you could do a kind of practice in which you're always on the alert for any signs of frustration when they come up, trying to see where the clinging attachment is that's driving that, and trying to get beyond that. Trying to get to a place of surrender, faith and surrender, that I know this will work, I don't have to keep doubting myself, I don't have to keep getting mad at myself and blaming myself or blaming the practice or blaming anything else because I didn't get the results I wanted. Just surrender to the process and have faith in it. I would use that as the counter towards the clinging and attachment that gives rise to the frustration. Because once the frustration is there, the frustration is actually, you know, it becomes self-fulfilling. I'm frustrated because I can't, blah, blah, blah. Well, because you're frustrated, you won't be able to, blah, blah, blah. You know, so it's important to work on the frustration itself.
And little by little, that back and forth in the mind is less, between the insights that you have, the true nature of reality, and then going back out in the world, right, and your mind working the normal way it does, even though you know these things, gets...
That's right. It gets less and less to the point where there's really not much difference at all between sitting on the cushion with your eyes closed and being in the world. And, you know, they're just slightly different versions of the same thing. That's when the smaller that difference is, the better and better things go, and the more quickly that you are able to progress. And when it comes down to virtually nothing, there was an interesting thing that I led a retreat in Massachusetts a couple of months ago, and one person, he's a very good meditator. It was the first time I'd met him. He was in a retreat, but towards the end of the retreat, he had this comment that he said, "I can't believe that when the bell rings, you just get up." He said, "Me, I have to, you know, I'm in this place in the meditation, and I can't just get up." And I realized that, yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about. But for me, it's not that much different. I sit down and close my eyes and meditating, unless I'm trying to achieve a particular state, you know, there's hardly any transition at all. If I'm trying to achieve a particular state, if I wanted to practice jhana or mahamudra or something like that, well, I sit down and it takes a little while to get from here to there. But often I just sit down and I'm really continuing what I was already doing. I'm just doing it in a much more secluded and conducive environment by sitting with my eyes closed. And the same thing when I get up is I'm often continuing my meditation as I get up. And so that's what you can look forward to. They get closer and closer. Now there is this mythical place that I certainly haven't reached that yet, which is the place where there's nothing more to learn, nothing more to discover. And I suppose when you get to that place, and you don't need any of this anymore, but somehow I don't believe that exists. I think that really is a myth. The quote, "totally enlightened being for whom there's no more learning." Maybe there's no more learning when the body dies.